Well, I want to ask you a fairly fundamental question. What does it mean to believe Jesus? What does it mean to believe Jesus? Now, I've not asked you what does it mean to believe in Jesus, because you'll appreciate in our country that expression has come to mean something very weak, nothing more, in fact, for many people, and I simply believe that he existed. No, I'm asking the question, what does it mean to believe, that is, to trust Jesus? A friend I spoke to during the summer series asked me what I've been up to. I said, I've been working on a survey. We've been working on a survey that says, who do people on the coast think that Jesus is? I said, it's been lots of fun. I've got ideas on that one. And he said, I think Jesus is our Lord. I said, wow, that's terrific. I thought, that's terrific. I'm a little surprised. I wouldn't have expected that of you, my friend, but I won't tell you what his name was. And as we continued our discussion, I said, you believe he's been raised from the dead? He said, yeah, I believe he's been raised from the dead, absolutely. I said, that's terrific. I said, is it a truth, do you think, that affects your life much over the years? Have you noticed? He said, no, I wouldn't say it's affected my life very much, but it doesn't do any harm to believe in it. Now, that's a telling statement, I reckon, right there, because it is possible to believe in something. It's possible to believe in Jesus as an article of faith. But my question today is very different. What does it mean to believe Jesus? Now, do you see the difference? Biblical Christianity is really very simple. Christ comes into our world claiming to be the rightful king. He says there's more to life than this. He says there is an age to come. And there's a need to stand before him that you might, and acknowledge him for who he is, that you might enjoy that life. And he proves the substance of his claim by rising from the dead. And then he invites people, believe me. Put your confidence, that is to say, put your trust in me. Now, if you do that, if you trust Jesus about there and then, you can be sure it'll have implications for here and now. You can be sure of that. Because your convictions about the future always shape the present, don't they? They always shape the present. So imagine you go to play a game of tennis. But imagine how differently you'd play it if you thought a tennis match was one set instead of five. Do you know? The Australian Open would be very different if that were the case. Or if you decided to run in the Sydney to Melbourne Ultra Marathon, imagine. And imagine you thought it was a 200-metre sprint to the aeroplane followed by a relaxing flight to Tullamarine Airport. It'd be very different, wouldn't it? You'd engage in the sprint very differently. Or if, for example, you thought that life ends at 21, as actually most 21-year-olds think. Now, if you thought that, you'd engage in those 21 years very differently. Or if it was 31, or if it was 51. It'd be very different because what you expect of the future is shaped immensely, or at least shapes immensely what you do in the present. The passage today deals with that kind of issue. Jesus says there's more to life than this. So if there is a there and then, what does it mean for my here and now? The passage today will search us on that. Notice the context of it. Come quickly to the text. If you haven't got a Bible, try to look on with someone. Worthwhile to bring one with you, because the things we're looking at are so immense week to week. They're massive, so it does repay the investigation. Notice the context. Verse 1 there, Jesus is addressing his disciples, his followers. But it's very clear in verse 14 that the religious people of the day, the Pharisees, are listening in as Jesus relates this parable, the point of which is that future reality determines your present priorities. Verses 1 and 2, notice the story Jesus tells. There's a rich man who's just got wind that his business manager, his chief steward, has been misusing company funds. So on a Friday afternoon, he summons him in to give an accounting of what he's done with the things that have been entrusted to him before sending him off for the next Monday morning to the CES to go and get a new job. And the next thing you see, verses 3 and 4, is the manager's response. It suddenly dawns on him in a flash that the future he'd always imagined is about to change enormously. There's a radical change. It's on his immediate horizon. It's a crisis time for him. So verse 3, he realises, I don't have the physique to be a brickies labourer. Begging doesn't really entice me as a career option. So he devises a plan for his future, verse 4. And notice it. Because it's actually very straightforward. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses. Now, there's the beginnings of his plan. Notice a couple of things about it. It's based on two facts. Firstly, life as he knows it is about to end. Secondly, he needs to provide for his future. Now, they're two simple facts of life, aren't they? We all know them this morning. Our friends all know them. Very few of us think that death is the end. Jesus assures you that it isn't. There's the first thing to note. One day each of us are going to die, or he'll return. Whichever comes first, we don't really know. Either way, life as we know it is going to end, and we're going to be ushered into an eternity. Now, it's worth this while this morning recognising you may be here and you're just investigating these things for the very first time, or actually you've thought about them for a long time. And perhaps you've not reached suitable conclusions on them, but have you considered what this means for you? One day, you'll face an eternity. You'll face God in eternity. He'll ask you to give an accounting of your life, just as he's asked this man here. It's a strange world, I think, that we live in. It teaches us to plan for possibilities, but not for certainties. So that's a strange world to live in, isn't it? I think it was Benjamin Franklin who made the observation that nothing is certain except for death and taxes. Jesus adds a third one to that. He says there is a certainty that there's a life beyond this one and that you need to be prepared for it. So are you prepared this morning? There's the first thing that the parable brings to you. The manager knew that. He knew there was a future he needed to prepare for. And so, verses 5 to 7, he hatches his plan, which basically consists of this. He will slash the bill of all his master's debtors so they'll think he's wonderful, and when it comes to his future, he'll be welcomed. So verse 5, he summons them in one by one. How much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil. He says, make it 450, but I want it next week. Calls in the next one. Verse 7, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. You're breaking my heart, he said. Make it 800, but make it quick. Now, it's useful to know these are not insignificant amounts. You know, it's estimated that the oil alone would have cost 3 years of an average salary if you were a labourer in those days. That is a lot of produce right there. So you can imagine the reaction of his debtors, can't you? This is Christmas time for Jews, which is something that doesn't happen every day of the week. But that's not the point yet. Likewise, it's helpful to know that the Old Testament forbade Jews to ever lend out money and require interest back of other Jews. You weren't to do that. And so the sinful nature being what it is, managers like this work out a way to get around it. They would simply build some fat into the bottom line without calling it interest and just simply get around it like that. So it's very likely this man was simply removing his cut, removing the fat he'd built into the bottom line. And that's helpful to know, but it's not the point, not yet. Finally, one thing is very obvious. This manager is dodgy. You know, various commentators want to get around that in some fashion. No, he's just dodgy. You're meant to notice that. But he's cunning because he's put his boss in a very tricky situation. What is the master to do? Option number one. Option number one, he can explain that the manager is a cheat and a fraud. He's not been authorised to make any of these deals. He can sack the manager straight off. He can reinstate the original bill, but he will then lose his reputation as good guy of the year. It'll just go down the tubes. There's option one. Option two, he can take the loss on the chin. He can sack the manager as he planned to do anyway. He can say the bill is cut. And he can bask in the warm glow of his new public profile. Which would you do? There's a lot of money at stake. He takes option two. But that's not the point. Not yet. The point is in, if you're wondering and struggle with this parable during the course of the week, the point is in verse 8. The master commends the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. Now, that is a little bit of a shock, isn't it? You find that a little bit of a shock as you read it during the week? I remember the very first time I ever read this parable. I'd never opened the New Testament before, but I knew enough about it to know Jesus was meant to be the good guy. Actually, I understood he was meant to be the God guy. And so I was really waiting for the bit that says, but I tell you, do you know what the manager said there was complete rubbish? I was waiting for that bit, but it didn't actually come. Jesus is supposed to be the good guy, the God guy, and here he is commending the example of someone who is absolutely slippery. That's the case. Does God approve of lying and cheating? No, that's to miss the point. The answer is no, but it tells you something about the nature of the gospel accounts. Just consider for a moment, if these were just made-up stories designed to tell some moral truth, and you were making it up, wouldn't you choose more carefully a more conventional hero? Why would you choose a hero like this man, the one who actually is so very obviously slippery? The fact that Luke hasn't done that is a sign of the authenticity of the accounts he's writing. He's simply reporting what Jesus said, with all the oddities of it. There's the first thing to notice. But if that's what he's doing, what's going on here? Now, for some of you, reading this kind of stuff might be very new for you. Reading the parables requires some care. The first thing you need to note is check who's being addressed. We've done that. It's the disciples who are being addressed, with the Pharisees in the background. It's useful to know. But the second thing is it's important to check the punchline. Is there some editorial comment that's made there that tells you what the take-home message for you really is? And there is. Did you notice it? Has Lynn read it for us before? Jesus gives it to you. See, again, it's in verse 8. Verse 8 tells you what Jesus is commending and what he isn't commending. He isn't commending the manager's truthfulness. He is commending his shrewdness. He's hard-headed and thoughtful. In fact, he got this fundamental point right. Future reality must determine present priorities, especially when it comes to worldly wealth. So the manager made the tough decisions that he needed to make. He used what he had, or at least to say, he used what his master had to ensure that he provided for his future. Now there's the parable, and Jesus has drawn the conclusion for you, but he goes further. He does my job. He now applies it to those who are listening, as a good preacher ought to do. He applies this three ways to all those who claim to follow Jesus. And here's application number one. Application number one is this: Christians aren't very good at this. Christians aren't very good at it. Note the comparison in the second half of verse 8. Come to the second half there of verse 8. Again, if you haven't got a Bible, you'll see why you need to bring one. The people of this world, that is those who don't believe, are compared with the children of the light, those who do believe. And Jesus says that those who don't are far more shrewd, far wiser and more understanding at dealing with those things of their generation, by which he tells you in the very next verse he means worldly wealth. They're much shrewder, much wiser than those who do believe. Even if the thing that the unconverted person is investing in is just very short term. Now, have you noticed that before? That our friends who aren't Christians are very wise at investing for the future, very wise at dealing with just money. They spend hours reading up on the markets, developing systems, researching superannuation rulings, developing passive income streams and investigating insurance policies and all sorts of things. They're very, very hard-headed and shrewd at preparing for the future. You may have heard the story about the family from the exclusive suburb in New York who had the luxury Merc in the driveway, and they woke up one morning and it wasn't there. They assumed that someone in the family had borrowed it and taken it out, but as they counted the number of heads around the breakfast table, they realised they were all there. No, someone had stolen it. 3 days later, the car appeared back in the driveway. It was washed. It was polished. There was an envelope on the windscreen, and inside was a note, and the note read this: "Dear neighbours, please forgive us. We had an emergency and borrowed your car without asking. We're so embarrassed and ashamed. Please accept this token of our appreciation." Inside were four tickets, $200 tickets to the New York Ballet. Off they went. They had a wonderful night. They sat in a private booth. They drank champagne. It was tremendous. They arrived home to find the house cleaned out from top to bottom. Not a thing in it. Now, whatever you think of that, you've got to say that's very cunning, isn't it? That's very shrewd. And I reckon that's exactly what the rich man said. That manager of mine, he is one cunning son of a gun or something like that. But Jesus says, when it comes to investing, even though the future we believe in is permanent, not temporary, it's weighty, not trivial, Christians are rarely this shrewd. Not talking about dishonesty, just talking about shrewdness. We're rarely this shrewd. We show less insight, less diligence, less ingenuity, less daring, less perseverance. We're not very shrewd when it comes to this. Just think of, and I realise it must only be me, but just think of ProMaster Pest Control. Who knows ProMaster Pest Control? Only a few of us, but why is it they always phone me? Did one of you give them my phone number? I don't know what it's about. ProMaster Pest Control, have you ever received a phone call from them, those who do? Just one? Constantly I receive phone calls from ProMaster Pest Control. They never give up. Imagine you had an appointment with ProMaster Pest Control. They've come to spray your house, you're not there. They're going to spray it anyway, but they're going to ring you the next day and say, and by the way, do you want a termite inspection? I know them so well. Or you miss a dental appointment, bang, they're on the phone the very next day or the very next hour. Do you know you had an appointment? Do you want to make another one? Do you reckon Christians would do that? Can you imagine getting a phone call? Notice you weren't at church on Sunday. You know, I didn't see an envelope from you in the giving this Sunday. Can you imagine what it would be like if that were the case? Christians are rarely like this. Non-Christians, those who aren't believers, almost always are, because there's money involved. So for ProMaster Pest Control, it's their retirement that they're building for. That's what's at stake. So a frustrated tone of voice doesn't deter them. My continual lack of enthusiasm for what they're offering doesn't in the least discourage them. Amusements don't divert them. They just, 24 hours, 7, they're on the case, working away at it. Now, what's the future for the Christian? It's not retirement. It's just eternity, that's all. Just forever and ever, that's all. That's what's at stake. Now, why are Christians less shrewd with worldly wealth? Jesus says they are. There may be a number of reasons. Let me suggest just two possibilities. Two. Here's the first one. I suspect it's not that we don't know the full truth. I suspect it's that we often operate with only half the truth. Let me explain what I mean. It's not that we don't know this, but we know our lives aren't to revolve around money, the making of money. We know that. And we don't want them to revolve simply around money. But we do need to be concerned about the wisest use of money. And I wonder if it's the second part that we frequently forget. Now, it's not to revolve around the making of it, but it certainly is meant to be about the wisest use of it. And that's the point of verse 9. For when Jesus says there, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it's gone, you'll be welcomed into heavenly dwellings, he doesn't mean if you put plenty in the plate, you can buy God off. He's not meaning that. No, no. He's reminding you about the manager. Come back to verse 4. Because verse 4, the manager saw what was on the horizon and he realized that these people would now be a big part of his future, those who he had been working with. And it's the same point for the Christian. If you believe that heaven is your future and that's your expectation, then make sure you use your money now for the sake of those who will be there then. Is the point that Jesus is making. That is, ensure your future reality determines your present priorities. In every aspect of life, but especially this one, especially with respect to your money. And that brings you to the second reason why Christians are often not wise with these things. Because just consider for a moment, and I realise these are hard things to hear, but consider for a moment, if you're not investing in eternity, that is, not much of your money ever goes to gospel ministry, why might that be? Now, I'm not asking for volunteers, but why might that be? It's not simply that you don't believe in Jesus. It's never that. But most likely, it's that you don't sufficiently believe his words when he speaks to you about the future. If you did, we'd all invest in it, wouldn't we? Now, isn't that why, and you people have been so wonderful in this, it's why you gave so sacrificially when we wanted to build the building. Because you had bought into what Jesus is saying about the future. You heard it, you trusted it, you know that the gospel is the key to the future, so we want to invest in that. We want to pack this place out with people who currently don't know Jesus. It's why we've got mission partners all over the world. We've got them in Strasbourg. We've got them there because Europe is post-Christian. I went to Europe a number of years ago. I had a great time talking to all sorts of young people there. Who do they think Jesus was? The degree of ignorance about that was profound and troubling. It's because Europe's like that we've invested in mission partners in Strasbourg and in Tanzania and in Nepal and Southeast Asia and in Wollongong and in Mackay and in Newcastle, because in all those places there are people who are ignorant about the gospel. Goodness, they're even on the Central Coast. Even in other nations like Tasmania. And because we want to reach all those nations, or at least God is intent that he'll fill heaven with them, we've bought into the future. We want to invest in that. Therefore, why wouldn't you invest in that if you're not investing in that? Why wouldn't you? Now, there's no great mystery there, is there? It's that you simply don't believe what Jesus is saying about that future. Therefore, the issue is not do I believe in Jesus, it's do I believe Jesus? Remember the BlackBerry smartphone? Some of you guys used to have one, I remember. Last year, the CEO of BlackBerry Smartphones, after writing a glowing annual end of financial year report, sold every share he had in BlackBerry. 26,400,000 of them. What do you reckon that says about what he thinks about the future of BlackBerry smartphones? Not very good, I would guess. And the point is very simple. If you're not investing in the business, that is, if you're not investing in the future, then it means surely that you're not convinced about it. Doesn't it? I mean, it's exactly the same for us. J.C. Ryle, J.C. Ryle, that name. He was a famous British Anglican bishop back in the days when Anglican bishops in England were worth listening to or wrote anything that was useful. Let me read you what he says. He says, "The diligence of worldly men about the things of time should put to shame the coldness of professing Christians about the things of eternity. They improve their opportunities, we waste ours. They redeem their time, we squander ours. They seize the moment to increase their riches. We live as if we expect to live here forever, as though there were no eternal riches in glory." Now, that may not be true of you. This congregation is absolutely wonderful when it comes to this. But as a church, we're not interested in your money. Do you realise? Jesus is not interested in your money. We're just committed. He's just committed to building Christians who believe him, believe what he says about eternity. Is that you? Is that you? Application number one is that Christians aren't very good at this. And there's a number of reasons why. Application number two is so important to get clear. It's this. It's what we call our possessions are actually simply goods that are entrusted to us. Come to verses 10 to 12 for a moment and notice something about them. Notice the word that's repeated through verses 10 to 12. Let me read it for you. "Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you've not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who'll trust you with true riches? And if you've not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who'll give you property of your own?" They're profound words there, and there's much we could say about them, but did you spot it? What's the word that he keeps repeating through that section? The thing that gives you a clue about what he's on about. It's the word trust. It's the word trust. And it tells you everything you need to know. What it says so emphatically is that the money that we have is not our own. It's been entrusted to us. It's on loan, just as it was to the manager. Therefore, there's a need for us to be trustworthy, honest in what we do with what actually isn't ours. Do you find this stunning? Do you find it cuts you to the heart? I know it does. I know it does because I've noticed the look on your faces all morning at this point. And I know you're wrestling with them all morning as I've been doing all week because I'm not just preaching this to you. I'm preaching this to me. What Jesus says is absolutely life-changing. Because if the things that I have, my gifts, my abilities, my possessions, my time, my intellect, my money, if those things are actually just on loan to me, then the way I use them is not a matter of personal preference. It's a matter of honest dealing. Am I using them honestly? So let's confide for a moment. I mean, don't tell me, as if you're going to anyway. But see, imagine this. In your heart of hearts, do you tend to think that what you have, your gifts, your abilities, your time, your energy, your money, do you tend to think that that's been given to you so you can live from day to day, so you can earn a paycheck, so you can keep the economy going? Do you tend to think that? I wouldn't be at all surprised if we tend to think it. Even though, you know what, most of us have heard these things again and again. Someone was saying to me over morning tea, I know those things again and again. I just wake up and I hear a sermon, I find I've drifted downstream like a bloke that's in a rip. Now, why does that constantly happen? Jesus will tell you in a moment. But consider the question he raises in verses 10 to 12. It's this. Are you being honest, trustworthy, with that which God has entrusted to you? Are you making good investments with God's stuff? Not your stuff, his stuff. Your gifts, your abilities, your possessions, your time, your intellect, your money. If you're not, remember this is a matter of privacy. It's you and God. It's not me. If you're not, let me suggest why there's no mystery. It's because when it comes to the things of God's stuff, money, we're not actually sure how much we can trust Jesus, how much we really believe what he's saying. Isn't that the case? I mean, it's just a slam dunk, isn't it? It's just dead obvious. Because if you believe him about there and then, it must affect your here and now. Notice too, by the way, those same verses, 10 to 12, notice why it's so important to get the small things right now. It is because our attitude to Jesus is forged in the small things. Let me tell you the impact for some of this passage today. And I want to let you know, it'll be the wrong impact. So let me give you that in advance. Part of the impact of this passage on some of us today, actually as I've wrestled with it during the course of the week, is that it will just annoy the socks off you. It'll just irritate you because it'll make you feel guilty and stingy and weak. And so you go home and you'll think, okay, I'll give away a large amount of money and you'll feel so much better for a short period of time until this passage comes up again or another one like it. Won't it? Now, that's not the point, of course. That's not the point. The point is to resolve firmly in your mind now or when you go home, how's my future reality and the expectation of that? How's it determining my present priorities now in the little things of life? How's that expectation of the future? How's it affecting me now? Do I even expect to be there in heaven? Well, if I do, how's it affecting me here and now? What I do with my money weekly? What I do with my pleasure weekly? What I do about the things of Christ daily? What I model to my kids constantly about the things of Christ. Because if you and your children aren't trustworthy in the little things here and now, see the impact of this? It may just mean that for you and for them, there'll be no there and then. Because you're actually not living for it. See how Jesus would cut right to the heart of this? He's not obsessed about money. Not at all. He just knows that money is a barometer of the heart. Do you know how you see people walk around from time to time and they've got one of those little pacemakers or some little thing that's constantly measuring their blood pressure on their arm? Wouldn't you love a device that constantly measures your spiritual health and you can look at it, like you look at your watch and you can see, my goodness, is that what it's really like? If you had something like that, would it be good? Could be terrible. It could be absolutely devastating. But imagine if you had something like that. You do. You do, says Jesus. The most accurate diagnosis of your heart is your attitude to your money. That's why he constantly talks about it. That's why actually through the pages of Luke, toed it up. He's constantly on about it. Because there's the measure of our hearts. The first application is Christians aren't great at this. The second application is what you have is entrusted to you, so be honest with it. The third application is this. The third application is that wealth easily becomes an idol. See it in verse 13. No one, says Jesus, can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. That last statement, gee, how many times have we heard that before? It is devastating. It leaves no middle ground. But you know, I think for the Australian Christian, especially the Australian middle class Christian, we're looking for the middle ground. Of all the people in the world, I reckon we're the ones who are dead certain there is one. We will find it. And of course, there is some balance to work out. We've got responsibilities to family, we've got responsibilities to the government, etc. But we need to work out, how do I deal with money? Is money evil? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. It's the good gift of God. We would know that if we ever suffered devastating poverty. Do you know, it's a good gift. It's a good gift. The problem is not money. It's us. It's the human heart. Because our hearts are always in search, says Jesus, again as he strips us bare, always in search of some other substitute God. Something else we can trust in. And money is just the perfect candidate. It's an idol that fits so well for us because it holds out to us the illusion of power. The illusion of control. You can control your future. You needn't be dependent on someone else. You needn't be dependent upon God. Money will insulate you from all of that. It's why, if I can put it this way, please don't be offended if I don't say much on this. It's why the prosperity gospel is such profound folly. Because do you see what it's offering? The very opposite to what Jesus is saying here. Not accumulate wealth. That's not what Jesus is. He's saying give it away. In fact, The Lord of the Rings, you've never seen it, you've never read the book, let me tell you all you need to know. You know, in The Lord of the Rings, the ring is the thing that kind of is the heart of the whole story. Everybody wants it, but everyone thinks they'll be different. It won't capture me, they think. I can use it for good. I'll be the one that's different to others. And so the reality is that all who possess it are captured by it and forced to march to its tune. The only safe thing to do with it is give it to someone else. Now, not this with money. Get rid of it. Destroy it. Not that with money. But now, the same point is being made here. Because of the nature of the human heart, worldly wealth is like that. It turns so readily from servant to master without us ever realizing that's the case. Without us ever realizing that a coup d'etat has taken place. Coup d'etat. God's been overthrown. He's no longer king. Wealth is the king. And we're not king, actually. We've become, to our great surprise, we've become enslaved. That's why, you know what the most chilling part of this passage is? Come and see it. It's verse 14. From verse 14, note what's said. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. Jesus' words always diagnose your heart. I think this morning is a case in point, not because of my preaching, simply because of what he says. But notice what's happened here for these guys. They hear the very words of the Son of God and they can't even see them for the truth they are. Can't even see it. Now, why is that? Because they've long since been captured. They were lovers of money. They're so distorted, they cannot see it, They cannot hear it. They cannot respond to it as they ought. All of which makes Jesus' words here radically important. There's not simply a future to prepare for. There's a slavery to escape from. How do you do that? Three quick things. Let me finish. Firstly, the one way to escape from the slavery to wealth is work out a practice by which you give it away. Now, we've got responsibilities, haven't we? Work out the practice, how do I give away? It's like the ring, the longer you hold on to it and accumulate it and possess it, the more it distorts you and you become more and more like Gollum. So practice giving it away. There's the first one. Secondly, as you do that, be shrewd. Be thoughtful and wise. For it's the future reality of heaven that must shape my present priorities. You can't take it with you. Do you know the interesting thing that Jesus is saying is? You can send it ahead. It's nice, isn't it? Oh, the money we have will actually be useful. That money which has been entrusted to us by God, the wealth, the possessions, the abilities, the skills, they astonishingly, they have value for this short age here and now, just for this age. And after that, nothing. No value beyond this. Therefore, invest them wisely here and now so they reap a benefit for all eternity. There's the second thing. Here's the last. What will enable you to do all this? What will enable you to break free from the captivity to wealth? Just this. That you have a clear and certain hope for the future. Is that you this morning? You have a clear and certain hope for the future. Is your expectation that I will share eternity with Jesus? The trials and problems of this world, they will be erased by a good God who intends me for eternity. Because only when that looms large on your horizon, only when the words of Jesus are actually believed, will it capture your hearts and realign your priorities so that you don't live the way the rest of the world lives. You live with wisdom and joy, not just for now, but forever. Now, Jim Elliot, they corrected me at 8:30 church, Jim Elliot was 24 years of age when he wrote these words. He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. He was 24 when he wrote that. You know, I kind of think for me, for most of us, it's better late than never. Isn't it? So how about I pray? Now, Heavenly Father, these are searching words. Your words always are. Father, we do get deceived so readily to think that what we've been given is actually ours. Help us be corrected in our thinking about this so that we'll be wise with what you've entrusted to us. Help us be generous and to be thinking of eternity. Help us be people, Father, who want in this age to make an impact on those around us so that we'll see them in eternity and we'll enjoy it with you. We ask it in Jesus' great name. Amen.